On the show today, we feature a presentation by Uncle Colin Jones. As part of my job as a cultural educator and medical educator is to run cultural immersions for doctors. Aboriginal elder Uncle Colin Jones, a highly educated man who has lectured at many tertiary centres around the world, joins me to present to my GP registrars on the Bunya Mountains immersion. In this presentation, Uncle Colin provides a historical insight into racism in Australia under colonisation. And I believe everybody should listen to it to understand the origins of the mistreatment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Prepare for your mind to be blown.
Indigenous Health Med Talks with Dr. Danielle Arabina, yarning with innovators, trailblazers and community leaders in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and medicine. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this podcast may contain the voices of persons now deceased. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Yuggera and Turrbal people, from where Dr. Danielle is broadcasting, and extend our acknowledgement to the elders past and present of all our listeners.
Good morning, guys. As I said, my name's Colin, if that's the easiest way. Just to explain a little bit about me, I live in Toowoomba now. A lot of my family are originally from Cherbourg, where you guys, I believe, went yesterday, and from Stradbroke Island. So I have, my grandfather's people were Kalkadoon, Mount Isa. Kalkadoon comes from the term from the English. In language, they call it Kalkadoon because they romanticized everything, like Lorna Doone, all the dunes. In our language group, it's called Kalkadundi. And then the other side are Nunukal and Yugara, and you would have heard them as New Knuckle. It's pronounced or spelt N-U-N-U-K-U-L in language, Nunukal. And so I've got two sides of Aboriginal on that side. My grandmother's people, English, they arrived in Redcliffe at Settlement Cove in 1854, and they came from Stratford-on-Avon in England. They were very well to do, and I'm the end result of that one. And my great-grandmother was brought in the slave trade in 1872. She was brought from Raiatea near Tahiti. The English brought Polynesian women out as breeding stock for the European men for a period of time, and from New Zealand, from the Maori. And then we had the Kanaka slave trade from the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and so forth. So I'm a mixture of Polynesian, Aboriginal, and English. On my government files, I grew up in Cherbourg for quite a while. I'm a light-skinned half-caste getting closer to Octoroon, 1/8, because we were filed. And you got to remember, I was born 1947, so I've just passed my use-by date. I'm 71. But anyways, these are the things I want to talk about this morning, about the assimilation breeding out programs and why. And also, because you went to Cherbourg, I want to bring up a bit of the history there. I lived there, and I know all the background and the old boys' dormitory and whatnot and what used to happen. But first of all, what I'm going to go through is a little bit about Aboriginal history and naming of things. And this is very important because when you're dealing with strategy or dissecting things, you need to go back to the original, what happened and why. It's like guys who are doctors and studying to be doctors. You just don't walk into the doctor, into the GP and say, look, I've got a cold, I've got this, and I've got pains in my kidney or my side. The doctor needs to ask questions because he discerns what the problem is, where it comes from. It's the same with people dealing today with drugs, with crack and ice and alcohol. You have to go back to the roots of it, where it come from. So in our culture, yes, we have to go back to where we come from and the reasons why, because it's very important in Aboriginal culture to know your history. Because if you don't know your past, you can't survive in the future. That's in our cultural structure. First of all, we'll go through the naming of things. When things are named, you'll start off in a very derogatory state in some cases. When you look around the Pacific, remember the Royal Society of London, the Royal Society set up by Charles II, 1642 originally, and eventually became the Royal Geographic Society. They set up the Royal Society to advance sailing ships, studying the maps of the land, because England was a continent, an island continent. That's why we called it the British Isles. Its power was going to be the sea. That's why England became the leading naval sea fleets around the world. Now, what happened? They set up the theory of the Great Chain of Being. And have any of you heard of that one? The Great Chain of Being. Science dissected everything. They put it into little boxes. If it was round or oblong, it still had to fit into that little box. That's how science works, and it still does to an extent. And so challenge science. Science is good. Don't get me wrong, but it's there to be challenged as well. Otherwise, we just float along and believe everything everyone says. And we as individuals have to challenge things for our own self as well. Now, the great chain of being, the Royal Society of London originally set up these great chains. They had minerals, animals, fish, birds, plants, and humans. So the great chain of being comes from the great chain of human beings. Now, how that started off, you imagine a link of chains, and you divide it into three sections, into thirds. The top link was God, rightfully so for those, you know, that era. The second link were the angels. Next to the angels were all of the royalty, wealth, nobility of England and Europe. They were close to the angels, close to God, close to perfection, could do no wrong. And so then the rest of that top link were all the white races of England and Europe. They're up the top. The middle links were now all the Asian races. This is the start of racism in reality. The bottom links were all the black races. They were inferior. The very bottom link in that human chain, according to that great chain of being, was referred by the Dutch as hominbods, by the English as Hottentots. We would know them today basically as the Bushmen of the Kalahari in South Africa, the Kalahari Desert, because the Dutch kicked them out of the land was too valuable, and they were sent to the desert area. But their proper name are two clan groups. They're called the Khoi and the San. So we call them the Khoi San. And if you remember the movie, you know, with the Coca-Cola bottles and running around, yeah, they got, that's it, yes. Well, they are the Bushmen or the Khoi San people. They're a shorter people. Interesting, in my research, we had up to just over 300 of the Khoi San sent to Australia as convicts. You imagine that? Because where were they transported? All over Europe and to England as servants and as slaves and as curiosities. And if they did something wrong, they were transported. So in our research, we had over 300 of these people from South Africa sent here. Well, they couldn't have lived with Europeans. So obviously some of them had children to Aboriginal people. So that gene is in our culture as well in certain areas. Now, they were the lowest link in that human chain, the very bottom link. Now, later on, if you know a bit of our history, Australian history, if anyone's ever heard of William Dampier, William Dampier was an Englishman. He was a pirate and a buccaneer, an entrepreneur of his age. He used his form of piracy to get funding to explore and discover. He worked with the Dutch in the Dutch East Indies. He didn't like the Dutch, but he worked with them because he knew that was trade. And he got blown off course and hit the west coast of Australia in 1688. So he was the first Englishman to hit Australia, but on the west coast before Cook arrived on the east coast. But what he documented in his files, in 1688 he hit the west coast, in 1694 he produced 12 books of his voyages. And he documented so much stuff, and he became highly acclaimed in what he had done and what he had written. But now when I researched his books, I lecture in London and I do work at the British Museum. I say British, sorry. In our language, B's, H's, I's and A's, I have to rethink, because we say, instead of saying up in the air, I'd say up in the hair. If I said in my hair, in my air. Would you like a half an apple? You want a half a apple. When the British arrived? When the British arrived. So I have to stop and think, because my first language is Murray slang in that way. But anyways, so what happened? I knew that he was well-versed in the sciences, because what did he document? He said, a barren wasteland unfit for human habitation. Remember, he hit the west coast of Australia, very dry. And to him, after leaving Indonesia, trading with spices and so forth, and pewter, the tin and everything, when he got to Western Australia, they thought, well, no one's going to survive here. But then what did he say? These creatures of the great Southland, New Holland, not humans, these creatures, he believed were in fact less than the hominbods in South Africa. Interestingly, when you go through science, the hominbods or Hottentots, or the Khoi San, the proper name, they were the lowest link in the human chain. We were documented in 1688 as less than. Now, what does that come up into your mind? The theory started of the missing link in the great chain. And we were first documented as the missing link, less than. Now, the other interesting thing was, we were now set. We weren't quite human. We were the step between. Now, that all spread through England and Europe because through the sciences. And then what happened? We come further along to in the future. We had Lieutenant Cook sail up the East Coast. Now, Lieutenant Cook they keep saying Captain Cook. He was not a captain when he got here. He wasn't a captain until he went to Hawaii, and the other side of my ancestors made meals on wheels of him, you know, to a certain extent. But anyway, when Lieutenant Cook sailed up with Joseph Banks and to the tip of Cape York, has anyone been up to the tip yet? Good. You'll know what I'm talking about. You have Possession Island. You can see it from the mainland. Now, Possession Island was named by Cook because that's where he took possession of the east coast of Australia. And I always say that he must have eaten a whole bag of carrots that day because his eyesight was so good. Under the Westminster law system, the captain could claim the land for his king and country as far as his naked eye could see. So his eyesight was so good, he claimed all the way down from Melbourne all up the east coast of the tip. And he claimed it under terra nullius, a land devoid of human habitation. Because he knew that we were not documented really as humans, but he also knew that we were. But England could not afford to miss out on this great south land. Cook was a very humane man. I've been to every place in the Pacific where he's been. I've been to Tahiti about 15 times because I still have family over there. And I've been to Hawaii, I think, 36 times. Not that you want to know all that. But I lecture at different universities over there in Polynesian migration and navigation and linguistics. And so Cook claimed it under terra nullius. He claimed it for King George III, Great Britain, and named it New South Wales. We were new, we were south, and Wales after England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. Now, under terra nullius, a land devoid of human habitation virtually, that theory went through. The first fleet arrived, 1788. Science in England had already made an assumption that we were not quite human. And it eased the conscience of colonization, the impact, the shootings, the massacres, the poisonings, and so forth of our people, because we were not quite human. And some of the documentation on our early files is they felt less regret of shooting mere mongrel dogs than shooting the blacks of the country, because we were seen as a pest. We had a bounty on our head. And a dingo, only to what, 40 years ago, was £10 for a scalp. You know, so they made more money out of shooting Aboriginal people and taking their scalps and selling them. And so we were put into that category. We were classified as tailless monkeys, pesky nigger blacks, and all this all the way through. This was the theory, because it eased the conscience of colonization. And you think, that's a bit harsh. How could that be? Where's your proof? Always look for a bibliography. That's important. Now, the Reader's Digest Encyclopedia, 1964-1965, it comes up with the theory of primates. I know you can't see it very well from there, but you can have a look later. Now, the Reader's Digest Encyclopedia is a very well-respected encyclopedia, and it's still used today. It's been revised and so forth. And it's got all these drawings or etchings of primates. The second last one is an ape from then the Belgium Congo, when Belgium was colonizing the Congo. The last one, Australian Aboriginal. We were still filed under primates. So 1967, with the referendum, we first became citizens in our country, but we first became humans on the British files under the Westminster Law System and Science. Because what were we filed under to 1967? Flora and fauna, plants and animals. So that theory continued. Now, I was born 1947. So when I was 20 years and a couple of months and a few days old, I finally became a citizen of my own country and recognized under the Science Authority as a human being. That's in my lifetime. And you think that's just over 50 years ago. It's not long. So we've come a long way in that. And these are the things you've got to keep in mind, how a race of people has still survived. We are survivors in that area. And the term, the naming of things, the Royal Society of London named everything in Greek and Latin. It was the world's most spoken and written language at that time. So when you go around the world, to any of the zoos or animals, the zoological structure for the animals is Greek or Latin. The plants, Greek or Latin. Now, an example, when Lieutenant Cook sailed up the East Coast on board, who did he have? Joseph Banks, a very intelligent young man, I think 23 years of age, very tall, 6'6" or 6'4" or something, and very wealthy, very powerful on the Royal Society of London as a botanist and a scientist. And he looked down on Cook because he was a landowner, he was a gentry. And so he's up here, very aloof. So when he got to New Zealand, what did he do? He named everything after himself that he possibly could. So when he got to New Zealand, he got Banks Bay, Banks Peninsula, Banks Hill. He named them after himself, Joseph Banks. When he got to the east coast of Australia, he couldn't keep going with Banks Bay, Banks Peninsula, and Banks Hill. So he started naming things, plants. And when we go and look in the bush all around everywhere in Australia, we have all these plants called Banksia. Banksia this, Banksia that, named after himself, by himself. Then he named other things that, because Australia was so unique, our flora and our fauna was nowhere else in the world. So eucalyptus trees, there's nearly, I think, 700 varieties. Now the term eucalyptus, he named that. It's named from the Greek, eucalypti. And the good thing is about with Latin and Greek, you decipher what it means and where it comes from. So eucalypti in English, eucalyptus. It means you are well covered and protected. You think, what? The little seed pod that gets a little flower, so it's in the little pod that has a little cap on it. Remember the old stories, the gum nut babies they used to draw? When I was a kid growing up, I used to read those sometimes when I could get them. And so you are well covered and protected. Eucalypti, eucalyptus. Then we have Melaleuca, the paper bark. From the Greek, Melos Leucaros. Melos, black. Leucaros, shining light or moonlight. You think, well, how's that go to a tree? The paper bark, our bushfires, leaves a black ring around the paper bark. It's always got a black ring somewhere. That's the Melos, the black. Leucaros, shining moonlight. When the bottle brush flower comes out, the Melaleuca, it reflects the light of the moon. So black, shining moonlight, Melos Leucaros, Melaleuca. You go to our animals, we have the platypus from the Latin Platius pius or Ornithorhynchus, as we all had learned at school. And we have the echidna. They are the only two monotremes in the world. What is a monotreme? Egg-laying mammals. Interesting. The only two in the world. And their bone structure is reptilian. You look at an echidna and a platypus. When it walks, it moves like a goanna or a crocodile. Its eye structure is reptilian. What does it do? It lays eggs like a reptile. Interestingly, so platypus or Platius pius or Ornithorhynchus, big webbed feet. Echidna is quite a challenge. Echidna comes from the Greek echidnos, translated serpent, viper, or snake. You think, well, how do they get that out of that? Because Banks dissected, looked, studied, thought, wrote. He thought about what he was doing. So echidna, meaning serpent, viper, or snake, the male platypus, the male echidna, have a poison sac. During the mating season, the males fight with each other. So from the poison sac, a vein going down to the back leg with a fang on each back leg, like a snake. So hence echidnos, snake or serpent. And that's where the Greek terminology comes in. So it's good to learn all these things because it opens up a whole wide world. When I hear, I lecture at some of the high schools, and I have 26 grandchildren. Now, I just had a little girl in Japan 2 months ago. And they'll be out here another 5 weeks. I can't wait. My son just arrived from Japan this morning. Anyway, so when you look at these things and the kids say, I'm bored. I said, how can you possibly be bored? You know, I got my two grandchildren with me this morning and brought them up, and my sister's up here supervising them. And all the way up, I said, radio's off. No, I wouldn't allow them to bring their iPads or anything. Nah, we talk. And so I said, find something interesting and ask me a question. And my little granddaughter goes nonstop, which is good. And so we talked about the trees, the plants. We talked about the volcanic lava you can see on the hills here because there was a volcanic structure going up the coast. And the height and the difference in the vegetation and the climate. So they had a good, that's why I still got a voice left all morning. But it's good. I love to see them learn like that. And then I say, when we got here, I said, now, were you bored? No, Pa. I said, there you go. Don't tell me you're bored. It doesn't work with me. So there's no reason to be bored. You listen and you learn always. Now, we go back to the term of Latin and Greek. The Royal Society of London, after arrival here in exploration of the Pacific. See, the Pacific Ocean is named from the Spanish Pacific or Pacific. It means peaceful ocean. It's the biggest ocean in the world, but they call it peaceful ocean, Pacific. Now, what happened when Cook sailed out here, we had In the Northern Hemisphere, we had longitude going around the world. Then we had latitude, the lines going up on the globe, from the Latin term ladder, latitude, going up. They didn't have longitude in the Southern Hemisphere. Hence, the ships were going off course. They didn't know where to go. They couldn't document anything. The Dutch, when they finally got into South Africa, and then they come across to go up to Indonesia, what they do then, they call the Dutch East Indies at that time. So they had to go across the Roaring Forties and make a calculated guess when to turn north. Some of them didn't make it. That's why we have so many Dutch ships wrecked on the West Australian coast, because they just had to make a calculated guess. And even when Tasman sailed out from Batavia, which is now reverted back to Jakarta, he sailed across to Madagascar, and then he got the Roaring Forties underneath, missed the bottom of Australia, hit the west coast of Tasmania, sailed around to the east. He named it Van Diemen's Land, after the Dutch governor of Batavia, Antonio Van Diemen, and his wife Maria Van Diemen. In my research, I lecture at five universities in the Netherlands. It was, the theory was, he was engaged to their daughter, so to keep in the good books, he named it Van Diemen's Land, right? Then he set sail to the northwest in the Pacific, and he hit the bottom of the west coast of New Zealand. Then he sailed up the east coast, west coast of New Zealand, and he missed the Cook Strait as we know it, because probably it was all fog. And this counteracting history, but I lecture at, has anyone been to the Netherlands? Utrecht University, it's an 11th century university. I love lecturing there. The history of it, it's unbelievable. You know, they said he was too afraid to go on land because the Maori sent out a waka, their war canoes. They scuttled one of the longboats going between the two ships, killed the sailors and took four as hostages, which were Meals on Wheels. They were long gone. And then he didn't set foot on land, but he named it for the Dutch, and he named it Stuttenland originally. But when he got back to the Netherlands, they already had a Stuttenland, Staten Island, New York. The Dutch had colonized there. So they had to change it quickly, and they called it New Zealand, or the New Sea Land, New Zealand. And they have a New Zealand in the Netherlands, where they've reclaimed the land. Now they grow vegetables on it. And there's also a New Zealand near Finland, in that area as well. And so they named it then New Zealand, the New South Sea Land. And so he set sail. Then he went up around Fiji and took off back through the Torres Straits and back to the Dutch East Indies. So he was a very brilliant seaman at that time. He documented and navigated and started to map the world. So Cook was set out now to start to study longitude in the Southern Hemisphere. If you know your history, he came into Tahiti, and he studied the eclipse of the sun at Point Venus, he named it. And now he had longitude in the Southern Hemisphere. Then he set sail to New Zealand, then finally to the bottom of Australia, then started to sail up from around the Melbourne area up to the tip of Cape York. And that's how we got found from the European point of view in that area. Then we had the wars with the Americas, with the English and the local American guys, and kicked out the British. So all eyes now turned to Australia, because we were the last major continent in the world unexplored, unoccupied by Europeans. And so England got kicked out of the Americas. They had nowhere to dump their convicts, because America will start off with at least 60,000 convicts. And when I lecture in America, I lecture at 14 universities in the States, the guys get shocked. We didn't have convicts. I said, study your history. They sure did. They don't like that one. We do. We love it. You got a convict. You think, yes. But then what happened? All eyes turned to Australia. We became the next dumping ground for Europeans, for the convicts from England, that area. And that's where colonization 1788 started. And that's where our problem started. Now, going back to the naming of things, I went through that just to give you an idea. It's setting a foundation of what people's preconceived ideas were of us at that time. Now, naming was a very important thing for the Royal Society of London, and very devastating for the people they named. So you get into the Pacific, and my great-grandmother was Polynesian, and so what do we have the term? Polynesian. It's not our language. I speak Tahitian, Maori, Samoan, and Hawaiian. I lecture at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu, the University of Hilo on the Big Island, which I don't want to go there at present because it's still rocking and rolling. And I lecture at the King Kamehameha Private School in the Bishop Museum in Honolulu. Now, the word Polynesian comes from the Greek polos nesios, many islands, not our language. Now we come closer. We have Papua New Guinea, Torres Strait Islands, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Fiji, New Caledonia. It's known as Melanesia. Remember our Melaleuca, Melos Leucaras, Greek, Melos Nisios, Black Islands. So it's named after the people because they were black. You go north of Papua New Guinea, we have all the little islands. We call it Micronesia, from the Greek Micros Nisios, small islands. So what do you put in your phone? Little microchip. When you drive a little Nissan Micra, a little small one. So Micros, meaning small in Greek. And so we were named under the Royal Society of London. Now, go a little bit further, go to the Americas. What happened there with colonization? The Spanish and the English hit the east coast of the Americas. The world had not been explored, so they didn't know exactly where they were. So they believed they'd hit the east coast of India. So what'd they name them? Indians. Wrong term again. Later on, they found out, when they started to explore further and found it wasn't the east coast of India, so to rectify it, what'd they call them? Red Indians, because of their color. Wrong term again. It wasn't until 30-odd years ago, I think 36 years ago, roughly, that the Native American population went to Congress and demanded a name change. Keep their identity, Comanche, Navajo, Apache, Anasazi, and so forth, but come under the one group of First Nations. And that's why they're referred to as the First Nations. The term Indian is not a good name. Now, we come back to us, Aboriginal. Does that sound Aboriginal? It's Latin. And where does it come from? Originally, the Catholic Church. Now, has anyone been to Rome? Well, you go to Rome, I lecture in Rome, and you go to the main museum in Rome, right? And I have the advantage of going to the archives and going through stuff because I lectured twice with the United Nations in Stockholm and Sweden. Anyway, you could spend the rest of your life in the archives in Rome, believe me. And you go through the old books, you put your white gloves on and someone turns the pages and you can look and document. And it shows, we know the history, the Catholic Church taught the earth was flat. You sail too far over the rim of the world was the theory, right? And the etchings in some of the books has got these tall mountains, snow around the top with clouds. It goes right down to a lovely sandy beach. Then it's got these exotic palm trees around the beach. And walking around the beach, there's lions and tigers and elephants and giraffes and camels and so forth. And then it goes out to the sand. And then you've got the water. Then it goes over like a huge waterfall into a vast endless sea. And it's got these little openings underneath that shouldn't peer under the world. And it's got five big sea turtles and on the back of five big mammoth elephants holding up the plate of the world because it's flat. And every time the elephant moved its foot, it had a little earth tremor because Italy's well known for its earth tremors, right? And so that was the theory of the Catholic Church, the earth was flat. And if you go through the history, what did Michelangelo and Galileo, Michelangelo with the magnifying glass, he made the lens and then he proved that the earth was not the center of the universe that the church has said. It was the sun. What happened to him? He was excommunicated. He was imprisoned in his house until the day he died because he went against the church. The church couldn't afford to lose him. He was the artist. He painted the Vatican, the Sistine Chapel. So, but he was put into his house and that's where he had to stay. He had no choice because he challenged the Catholic Church. Now, what happened? Christopher Columbus comes on the scene. Now, he was Italian, but at the time he was working for the Spanish Queen Isabella and the Catholic Church in Spain. He approached Italy, the Catholic Church there, Portugal, and in Spain, they all refused him ships for exploration. Because they probably thought, why fund all this money on these ships and the earth's flat and he's going to go over the side and we lose everything? Why bother? You know, but finally, Queen Isabella, he softened her up and he said any lands he will find, he will claim for the Queen of Spain and any wealth for the Catholic Church. So they thought, oh, this might be a good deal. So they agreed and funded him three ships. Now, you remember what ship he was on? The Santa Maria, from the Latin Santos Marios, St. Mary. He sailed across the North Atlantic. He come down past the Florida Keys, around what we now call the Caribbean, and actually landed in Cuba, then back around the Florida Keys and back to Spain. What did he now have? Mathematical proof that the earth was circular. It was round. Catholic Church thought, oh, we can't lose out on this. He's got proof, so what are we going to do? If the earth was now round, through science, the Catholic Church jumped in to take control. So if the earth was round, Europe was a huge continent on top of the world. So all this land on top of the world on this big ball, uh-oh, we got a problem. There has to be another major continent underneath it to balance it. Otherwise, the weight on the top would make a wobble and topple over. So what'd they name it? Terra Australis Incognita, land south invisible. Remember, English is the only language that's back to front in reality. We are the dregs of Latin, Germanic, and French. So everywhere else, they say it differently. So Terra Australis Incognita, land south invisible. To us, great south invisible land. Now, anything on the top, they believed they were on top, so they were normal. Anything underneath was the opposite. Now, to give you an idea of that, what do we have? The Greeks knew the earth was round. If you read in Genesis, it said the earth is like a sphere, a round ball on an invisible thread. But the Catholic Church said, no, it was flat. So now if it's round, there had to be something underneath. What did the Greeks call way back? On the top, Attica. Artos from the Greek, giant bears of the north. Underneath, Anti-Artos, Antarctica, the demon monsters of the south. So what do you have? Artos, Anti-Artos. It's like in the Christian structure, Christ, Antichrist, the demons, the opposite. So Anti-Artos. So now go back to the Catholic Church, normal, underneath, abnormal. On the top, original, underneath, aboriginal. Not a good name. In Latin, the education department still teaches that the original inhabitants of the earth, study Latin, please. It says, from the origin of man, more closely related to primates than modern man. What does evolution teach? Man derives from monkey, more closely related to primates than modern man. So we were never given human status right back from the Catholic Church, way back there, aboriginal. The Royal Society of London, the most biggest and widespread society in the world at that time, documented all around the world. And so they jumped onto that bandwagon. No matter where the English colonized, they were aboriginal. So you got the Canadian aboriginals. We have in Japan, the Ainu, the aboriginals of Japan. So that term was used through science. And everybody accepts it because they think, well, they're learned people. They must know what they're talking about. But in reality, always challenge. My grandparents always taught me that, to challenge. You know, I mean, I was always told I was a half-caste mongrel-bred bastard. What are you trying to prove? You never get anywhere. Just go out and do labor. I thought, nah, I'm going to do something a bit different to that. You know. But anyways, so these are the things we've got to keep in mind. So now what we get, aboriginal, from the origin of man. So hence, that's why in our Reader's Digest encyclopedia, the primates, the last one, aboriginal. Not a good name to have, hey, when you look at it in reality. But anyway, that's enough of all that, I think. Give you a headache. But keep that in mind. It's important to know where names come from and the effect of that name. I mean, if you tell a little child he's dumb and he's an idiot and stupid, he's going to go out and believe he's dumb and he's an idiot and stupid. And he's not. You've got to praise up and do things and be reality and be honest and to the point. And that's so important with everybody. I mean, not just our people, everybody. But now, and now I believe, Cherbourg, you all find it interesting? I grew up there till I was 11. It used to be, it was never good, but it was better than being nowhere. I don't know what you got taught or told yesterday. A lot of my family still live at Cherbourg. Cherbourg was basically set up around 1900, 1902. They started to move people in. It was called then Baramba. We pronounce it Barimba. Now, the bridge you went over to go into Cherbourg, that's Baramba Creek in language Barimba, right? It was set up mainly as a dumping ground for anyone of colour, a force for cheap labour, and also an experimental mission to the assimilation breeding out programs. Quite interesting. It wasn't a good place. We were classified on the government files as inmates. You're in a prison. And that's what it was. Now, they would have taken you past and showed you the ration shed. And you know the history there. We had a line up there and get your blanket and get your flour and your tea and your sugar and whatever. And that was once every, I think it was every fortnight or every week, may have been, sometimes fortnight. And you get your meat. But we'd go up to the killing yards to get the meat. The main thing we got left was the offal, the insides, the liver and the runny guts and all the other stuff, and had to clean it and use that. And Did you see the old boys' dormitory? Did they point that out? Sorry?
No.
You didn't. Well, the boys' dormitory is up from the ration shed. Now, my wife and I set that up in 1984. The council, my uncle was the chairman on the council, Uncle Les Stewart, and he asked, would we come back? Because the children were being removed en masse, and rightfully, in some cases, rightfully so, but nowhere, they weren't put with Aboriginal people. This was the big problem. And children were getting removed and never seen their family and so forth. And the council come together and said, they want to stop this and we need to deal with our children ourselves on our community. So Uncle Les rang me up and asked me to come up, and my wife Gloria, because she grew up in the girls' dormitory, and because we didn't live there for a while, and we got out, and we don't drink, we don't smoke, we don't gamble, very boring people, and he wanted that influence back on the mission. And took us up there, and he said, look, we got the old boys' dorm, and we'd like to redo that up and make it into a home for children to be looked after and then filtered back to the family after the situation has changed and work with the parents. I said, that is good idea. That I'd get into and do. Anyway, so we went back, we got the old boys' dormitory, and we ran that for 5.5 years, and we looked after over 470-odd children in that the old boys' dorm. The language name is called Biama Yumba. Biama Yumba, home for many children, right? So what happened, we looked out, as I said, 470-odd children. Then I had a ministerial appointment to Cairns to work with the Magistrates Court and Juvenile Justice in all our remote communities. Now, when you get to Cherbourg, when I grew up in Cherbourg, I was there till I was 11, we had our language. We spoke English. We have a lot of words of the Aboriginal words, but if you spoke your language, it was stopped long before me, you were publicly disciplined if children would speak language. Before my time, children could have 1 hour, one day a month with their family. 1 hour, one day a month. If they come back to the dormitory and they were speaking language or acting in a way that was like native, you were publicly flogged to deter you from doing that. But English, we learned English, but we learned Murray slang. So I'd say, hey, brother, where you become from? Hey, I've been growing up. Who your family didn't be here? This in party? What do you matter about be here? That's English. Brother, where do you come from? Who has raised you? Who's grown you up? What's your family history and your background? Because when we address someone, traditionally, we must show respect for your forefathers. And so, hey, brother, where you become from, eh? Where you been growing you up? Who you founded in BA? Disimpati? What do you matter about? So it's slang English, Murray slang, you know? And we say, like, you hear the mothers singing out to the children, hey, Johnny, you get over here. You're not listening to me. You binagari, you stubborn, you hard-headed, blocked up, eh? So binangari, binang is here, gari is blocked. You're not listening. You're binangari, right? So little words we keep, but the reality of we spoke in Murray slang. That's why I said H's, B's, I's and A's are very hard for Aboriginal people to pronounce in that way. I mean, I lectured 8 universities in Germany, 5 in the Netherlands, 12 in France. In Sweden, I lecture at the United Nations, Stockholm, Sweden, I lecture there. I lecture in Switzerland, I lecture in Italy, I lecture in Spain, I lecture in England, I lecture in Hong Kong, Singapore, Shanghai, Taiwan, Japan, Hawaii, New Zealand, Fiji, and America. And no matter who I'm lecturing, I got to really stop because I'll still use my slang words and people, he's lost the plot, you know. So it's a part of what we are, and I'm not ashamed of that, of course. I mean, I try and do the right thing. My grandmother used to teach me English since I was little, and I had to learn, I'm sure you would have heard of it, the how now brown cow and the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. I said to my grand, what have I got to learn this for? And she said, to round out your vowel sounds. And I thought, oh God, when is this going to happen? But anyway, I still remember all that. And that's why I try and speak properly in that way. But anyways, so it's a learning process. Now, Cherbourg, we had the dormitories. We had a girls' dormitory, which my wife was in till she was 16. She got sent to Ipswich near Brisbane to work in the Catholic home there, the nunnery at the time it was. Then it became a mental institution. They've changed it to all sorts of things. And she was sent down there on the day of her 13th birthday. And her little room was a little A-shaped room above the morgue. You imagine putting Aboriginal children near a morgue. Not good. Her first job the next day was scrubbing the cement floor in the morgue with a dead nun laying on a slab. She was terrified. She took off, ran away. Because our people, with death, especially for children, nah, you don't go there. Anyway, I mean, we understand it, it's a different process. Anyway, so she got caught, brought back to the mission, publicly flogged, hair shaved, and 12 and a half weeks in jail at 13 years of age. On her government files, and this is my wife still alive. My wife is 12 years older than me. She's 83 and I'm 71, right? But we've been married 47 years, and my wife is the first and only lady I've ever taken out, and I still love her dearly. So if I do anything wrong, I always blame her. I said, you're older than me, you taught me everything I know. It works when you're a bit younger. Yeah. But anyway, not always. But anyways, so she got brought back, and that was on her files. It's got Gloria Gaylor, known as Solomon, because her family line are Aboriginal, but they were brought out in the Kanaka slave trade from the Solomon Islands and Gila Islands. So instead of naming all the people, they brought all the Kanakas, they call them, they just named them after the islands, a lot of them. So we have Leifu, we have Sullivan, we have Solomon, and all this sort of thing. And we can trace back to where they were. Anyway, it says, Gloria Gaylor, known as Solomon, unfit for urban work. Reason, absconding, running away. Recommendation, stay in dormitory till 16 years of age and then married off. You didn't have a choice of what you're going to do in your life. You know, that was it. Now, when I come along, I'm at school. This is on Cherbourg. And we had the old slates with the slate pen. Just the sound of those now make my cringe, you know. And I got removed from school at 11. I never knew why, right, because I thought I was doing okay. But I was sent to work on a dairy farm. What does it say in my files? It says, when you know our freedom of information? I'm 71, I got mine 10 years ago. Long time to get it. They're all hoping we all die before we get it. And mind you, two-thirds is blacked out. You don't get the whole lot. And it's got 11 years of age, light-skinned half-caste getting closer to octoroon. Reason for removal from school. A tendency to learn, a possibility of becoming cheeky. So I'm still being cheeky. And I thought, well, I was never cheeky. Why? The reason for cheeky, we had to be labourers. Boys were labourers, girls were domestics. That was your whole life theory. And so we spoke Murray slang. My second language, my grandfather taught me Tahitian because my great-grandmother was brought in the slave trade. And so he wanted me to have respect for that part of my culture. And Polynesian's on the tip of your tongue. So if I said to you in Tahitian, it's a lovely day, enjoy your day. Ya arana maite oi taramahitia atahoramaha. So a lot of it's on your tongue. And then we had the German Lutheran Church. So at five, I had to learn Prussian, 16th century German. So anyone speak German?
Nine.
Ah, das ist nicht sehr gut, ja. Ich kann Deutsch sprechen, sie, ja. Ich spreche das Preußisch, Hochdeutsch, ist all Deutsch. And we had to learn a verse of the Bible fluently each week and so forth, to be Christianized and civilized. Then my great uncle, Opa Jihoi, Chinese Aboriginal from Cooktown. Remember, we had over 18,000 Chinese into Cooktown to mine the Palm River goldfields. Now, these Chinese were not wealthy Chinese, as a lot of Australians think. They were the poorer people, the peasants of that area around Guangzhou, which English call Canton. And so what happened, they would send them out to pay back their debts they owed to the landlords. But the landlords would keep their wives and their children as collateral. And so they come out to make the money to pay back their debt. And a lot didn't make their money, so they didn't go home. So they stayed here in Australia. And of course, they couldn't live with white women. They were the yellow peril of the north. And so they cohabitated with our people, Aboriginal people. So we have such a mixture in our culture. We can never afford to be prejudiced to anyone because we're a mixture of everything. We should be proud of that. And so what do we have in Queensland? Aboriginal people under the name Jihoi, O-Chin, Chong, Go-Sam, Lee, Ah-Wong. Doesn't sound very Aboriginal. My great uncle was Opa Jihoi, and he was sent down from Cooktown. So at 6 years of age, what did he teach me? Guangzhou, which the English call Cantonese. So, Jo-San, Ne-Ho-Ma, Chen-Yang-Hui, Ma-Sali-Mo-Pa-Ying-Tao-Ma. So Cantonese is sing-song, kosher tongue, where Mandarin is glottal. Ni-Hao-Shung-Tao-Xie, Ni-Yong-Pa-Ying-San-Wa. So you get the different sound. But so anyway, so then my grandmother taught me the precise Queen's English. So by 11, I was speaking five languages. I broke the law as a possibility of becoming cheeky. So I'm still cheeky in that area. But these are the things. And remember the old dormitories, the boys' dormitory and the girls' dormitory, girls' dormitory got burnt down. A group of young teenage kids set it on fire when we were refurbishing it. We were trying to keep it, and because it's a part of our history, you know, it wasn't good. We need to have it. But the kids got it burnt down, unfortunately. But the boys' dormitory, we had 2-metre-high wire mesh fences. My brother-in-law was in the boys' dormitory with 3 strands of barbed wire. And if you were lucky, as I said, you could spend 1 hour, 1 day a month with your family and then back in, gates padlocked. So you can imagine what it was like. So what we're getting at now, here's all these children, not all, but a big percentage of children removed, and the parents didn't have the rights to look after their children. And if you were light-skinned, half-caste, you were quickly put into there to take away from the influence of the full blood. And that was a part of, well, colonization, Christianizing and civilizing, they said. We call it genocide at that time, back there. And then you look at Cherbourg. Cherbourg, as I said, was a dumping ground, anyone of color. So in Cherbourg, we had Aboriginal, dominant. We had Torres Strait Islanders. We had Melanesian from the Kanaka slave trade. We had Indian. We had Malay, Filipino, and Japanese mix. Anyone with a mixture, it was colored, was brought to that mission. And the area around there, because it was colonized and setting up as farms and cattle and sheep and so forth, they wanted the land. The land was too valuable. So we had to be removed off the land, but not too far away, because we were the laborers for that land. We were brought back out to work. Now you worked, you got your pay, not in your hand, and went to the superintendent. And that money went to the government or to the church. That's why we still have so much money in the coffers, or the government coffers, and they estimate now it's about $55 million. And that we worked, and that was 2 and 6 a week in the beginning. It's a lot of money to make $55 million, a lot of hours of working. And so we weren't allowed to have money. Remember 1967, under law with the referendum, in reality for a lot of our people, not all, because some of us lived within the city areas, but you first had the right to open up a bank account. You could further your education, seek your own employment, make your own marriage arrangements, apply for a passport, all that 50 years ago. So the impact on people as a race of people, we are still going through that, but we are survivors. We are still here. That's the other powerful thing I keep telling the younger generation. But the influence of coming in with everything else now is really devastating. Now, going back to Cherbourg, originally we had people from all over. My wife remembers we had groups living in different areas, and up the top camp, they had people up there used to do the crocodile dance. We don't have crocodiles in Cherbourg. They'd freeze in Baramba Creek in the winter. Those people were brought down from North Queensland. And so when they were brought down, they didn't stop their language, they didn't stop their culture. They were a people proud of their culture. So they do the crocodile dance, and they speak, the language they used to speak back there was Guku Imiji and Kukialanji, which we still have in North Queensland. And so it's interesting, the mixture of the people, it was a real dumping ground. Then they said that they had to change the name of the mission from Baramba. And that was their own Aboriginal language under the Waka Waka language structure. The reason was, they said, because they had Baramba cattle station and the mail was going to the wrong place and they wanted to change it. So what happened? We got changed to Cherbourg after France. Very Aboriginal. It was to commemorate all the Australian soldiers killed there during the First World War. So we got a European name of Cherbourg from Cherbourg in France. That's how we got that name. But interestingly, in the 1950 to 2001, they then changed it to the electorate of Baramba. They give the white people the name, but we couldn't have our name. So we got Cherbourg after France. And that was to Christianize and civilize, and people wouldn't look at us as being the black mission. So all these little things play into that. Then eventually, you imagine the children being removed nonstop into the dormitory structure. And the other thing I didn't say, some of you guys will know and research, the Royal Society of London found out we're the only black race you can successfully breed out the black in 2 to 3 generations. The reason being, we have a recessive gene in our skin pigmentation. So we can be bred out by breeding with white very, very quickly. Interestingly, we do not have a throwback unless we marry into another dark race, into our own race, who is darker, or into South Sea Island or whatever, Malay, and we can have that throwback. But in reality, we have a recessive gene. I'm going to read you quickly. I know I talk too much, but if you challenge me, please. The Assimilation Breeding Out Program. In 1947, the year I was born, each state had a minister for Aboriginal welfare under the Aboriginal and Opium Protection Act. Now, Western Australia had one minister there for all of that, that big state. His recommendation in 1947, the year I was born, it says, and this is from Blood on the Wattle by Bruce Elder, it says, A.O. Neville, the West Australian Commissioner of Native Affairs, claimed in 1947 that he had the scientific solution to the Aboriginal problem. When you go through history, it's important to go through world history. Hitler had the scientific solution 3 years before that. This was after Hitler. Scientific research, he claimed, had revealed that the skin pigmentation could be bred out of Aboriginals in 2 to 3 generations. Then what was his recommendation? If only he could have the money and the legislative power to start a selective breeding program, he could, in a matter of 60 to 70 years, solve the Aboriginal problem. We were a problem because we were dark and a white policy, by breeding a race of white Aboriginals for the White Australia policy. So when you look at that, it was a documented, researched, scientific theory and worked of assimilation breeding out. So what happened after that? Mass dormitory set up at removal of children. And what were we filed under? I have, I'll just show you, my mum-in-law. We come under the Aboriginal Protection and Restriction of the Sale of Opium Act, right? You didn't have a birth certificate. You were documented by the government. And that's why a lot of our older people, they still don't have real birth certificates. It's got Maudie Solomon, my mum-in-law. Now, Solomon, because named after the Solomon Islands, and she grew up on Fraser Island. See, remember, the Kanaka slave trade, as they called it, came into Mackay and into Maryborough. They were the two major ports in Queensland where they brought the slaves in. And so it's got breed. We didn't come under humans. We're under breed. You think of animals like pigs, chooks, cows, whatever. We were bred. And breed was half-caste. And then it goes through the children and so forth. So they're all under that structure of half-caste. My grandfather, it's got on his, Godfrey Stanley Higgs, breed half-caste, born in Gympie, 1892. It's got nationality, Aboriginal, mother Aboriginal and Kanaka, Otaheite. So that's how I could trace back. And her name was Tiare Maitiopoi Tavita. And Tiare means a little white flower with a perfume. Maitiopoi means little brown pearl of the sea. And Tavita were the tahuna. They were the high priests. They were a very bloodthirsty little lot, but they were the navigators. So I now lecture in navigation at 2 universities in Hawaii and 3 in New Zealand in Polynesian migration and navigation. So that's how we were filed under that structure. And then when you look at that, for the assimilation breeding out programs, what they would do, I mean, this one here, the stolen children, it's got, all they had to do was take a photograph of our people, the children. And because we would come under the title of half-caste, quarter-caste, quadroon, octroon, and then we were building up, we were getting more and more light-skinned kids everywhere in all our missions and reserves. And in Cherbourg, what'd they do? They blamed our young women for taking white people from Mergen astray. We're 5 kilometres out from Mergen. They would sneak out there to find the women, right? And then the children born were light-skinned. And as they were building up all these light-skinned children, then they wanted to get them out into white society. So it says, homes are sought for these children. So the local missionaries would take photographs and the local papers and also the main, like Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane papers would take photographs and say, homes are sought for these children. And it's got a group of tiny half-caste and quadroon. So when you're half-caste and quadroon, they automatically, oh, they're lighter. We can look after them. They can work for us. And this one here, I read the original files. It says, I'd like the little girl marked with the X as she is light-skinned. If she is not available, I'll take the little one next to her. She is also light-skinned, only if they are hard workers. That one looks like 3 and that one looks like 5. You had to be hard workers. And then when you go a bit further and you look at our people, my great aunt, I don't know which one she is in it, it says, cheap labour, Aboriginal children under government protection are used to pull a plough. This is in Weipa in the 1930s. Here's all the children chained up to a plough from about 5 to 11, and there's the minister with the plough behind it, and they're pulling the plough. That happened everywhere. There was other things you did as well. So when you look at all these things, we were not quite human, so it eased the conscience in that theory of science that we were black and we were right down the bottom and we weren't really worth anything. And the theory was, in the White Australia policy in 1901, the full bloods would die out, the light skins could be bred out to keep Australia pure white stock. That was the theory in 1901. So, as I say, we have survived all that in that era. And then we had the study of phrenology, the measurement of our heads, and they'd get an Aboriginal skull, a European skull, fill it up with sand in the brain cavity, pour it into the scales, weigh it. The European skull held more sand, so therefore his brain was bigger, therefore he was more intelligent. This was the theory of their science of phrenology, which of course is now proved wrong. And you toast that back, because you always look for the background and where it started. And you go back to England, medieval Europe and England. They would, when a child was born, they'd measure its head, they'd feel the cranium, the sutures in the skull, and they believed through science back there they could tell if that little child's going to grow up to be a liar, a murderer, or a thief, all this theory. So they were still practicing that on our people after colonization. They used every means they possibly could in that area. So when you look at that, we have survived. But going quickly back to Cherbourg, I dread going to Cherbourg now. It upsets me. I don't know about you, brother, but I see what's going on. We have some really good, decent people out there, but the younger generation, not all, but a percentage. And when you go back, it's the parenting skills and what's not happening. And now the alcohol, even though we're supposed to be banned, but I'm in contact every week and I know who's drunk and who's doing what. And I said, well, how? I said, we could get a job smuggling all around the world, I think. But anyways, and the problems now with the parents. But then you've got to go back and look at two sides. Remember, children were removed to the dormitories. Parents had no say. Parents could not look after their children. Parents could not hug their children, love their children, discipline their children. So that was taken away over about 3 to 4 generations. Then when the dormitories closed down and we got so-called dog at land and whatnot, you remember Auntie Nellie Sheridan? Yeah, Auntie Nellie was my aunt. Right? And she grew up in Woorabinda for a while. She got sent to Woorabinda when she was 13 because she slapped the matron across the face with a wet cloth because the matron called her a gin. And she says, I'm not a gin, my name is Nellie. And she slapped her across the face. Well, she got sent to Woorabinda as punishment, which was our punishment settlement. And Auntie Nellie used to tell me, she said, oh, now we got our land back, I'm going to buy my house finally. Didn't happen. We weren't allowed to own houses on the land. So all these little things. And of course, what happens? Parents now, because they've had no bringing up by their parents in a lot of cases, not all, but a lot of cases. And what do you do as a parent? My kids are not going to go through what I went through. So they go the opposite way and give them too much and spoil them and stick up for them. No matter if that little Johnny went down the road and smashed 14 windows and whatnot, mother going to say, nah, he was home with me. He didn't go down there. But 6 people might have seen him. So they stand up for the children. So the children are used to getting out of things. And of course, when they hit 18, the big house, jail, then all of a sudden, drama. And that's why we have a lot of deaths in custody. I mean, that's a part of it. There's a lot more involved. But so we're going through that now, and let all our communities, the problems we have with drugs and alcohol, crack, ice, marijuana has always been there, and that's getting out of hand. Because, as you know, it's killing our people. It's killing all people. I mean, I work with the Murray Courts in Toowoomba, and I got so many young fellas I counsel. I had 13 or 15 guys on Tuesday. And a lot of it's to deal with drugs and so forth and DVOs and things like that when they're under influence of drugs or alcohol. And I had one young lady at court and she was so high and high, she fell off the chair in front of the magistrate. I mean, not shame, but that's what happens, you know. And so, and they grow up and they think this is normal. And it's not normal. And this is a big problem we have to deal with. Not, as I say, not just on our missions. It's happening everywhere. I mean, if anyone's been to Amsterdam, I mean, a lot of things are legal over there. I saw this, he was from the Dutch East Indies in the Caribbean. He's reggae hair and he's riding his push bike and you could hear the boombox going, you know, Buffalo Soldier, and he's really going, you know. Anyway, the guys on the bus stop, the white Dutch guys, are like this to him, whistling, And he comes over, and I'm standing at the bus stop, and I think, oh, okay, you must know them. You know, real naive I am. I don't even smoke. But anyway, what happened? I'm watching, and he hand in his bag, at his little bum bag, we call it, and he pulls out this little white powder in a little satchel, and he slaps him on the hand like that, and he goes like that. Then he goes underneath. Like, you think he was doing a welcome like Al Murray ones, you know, handshake. Anyway, then I'm watching. Anyway, the little white packet of powder goes on top of his hand. Then he puts his hand underneath, and the guy's in his fingers, got the notes, and he pulls the notes out. He's done a deal. 11 o'clock a day at the bus stop. I went, oh, that's interesting. You know? So, I mean, it's everywhere. So it's not just our people. And that's the thing. Oh, what have I missed? Oh, Bungye Mountains. Yes, from my research and what my grandfather used to tell me, it's very interesting because here, Europeans said we had no idea of commercialism. We were prehistoric, not quite human, and what do we know about anything commercialism? Challenge that hundredfold. Now, the Bungye Mountains, our Bungye nut trees, because we say anything that's important has a double name, Bungye Bungye. We have a club. It's not called Nulla. It's called Nulla Nulla. The Europeans name things after our language. What we have in New South Wales? Wagga Wagga. So when it's a double name, it's the importance of it. So the importance of the bungye nut, the bungye bungye, pines and the nuts are full of protein. They're very good. And they're a food source which can be protected, looked after, and last. You can grind it to a flour, make it a Johnny cake, or you call it now, or a little damper, and you can dry it. And you can use it in a year's time just by adding water. It's preserved. So what happens? They come on roughly every 3 years. So the people around here would send out runners or messengers. Now, we had runners or messengers. They carried no weapons, right? They had the design on their chest and the artwork of their clan groups, where they belong to. And what did they carry? A message stick. It could be either burnt or carved patterns or painted patterns. That message stick, even though it didn't literally say anything on it, they knew where it came from and what it was about, and they were like a passport. You imagine we had up to 600 to 800 languages in this whole country. Originally, they estimate. How do we communicate? W.R. Roth, a medical practitioner from Stradbroke Island in the late 1800s, he was a botanist and so forth as well, and also anthropologist. He documented our sign language. We used over the whole continent one sign language, which is so interesting. And they say in our linguistics that it was so unique, it was equivalent to another spoken language. So what do you do today when you have sign language for people who can't read, can't hear and can't speak? They use the sign language and it's documented. We had that long before Europeans arrived, which is interesting. So they'd send out messages or runners and they go to all the areas around that some were not close. They had to go a long way, you know, a few weeks traveling. And as they were coming into another community, another clan group of people, the warriors would watch. Someone's coming. They're strangers. Are they a threat to our people? And so what would happen? As they got closer, they'd see their hand out with the message stick, and they were carrying no weapons. As they got closer, their body art, their totem structure, where they belonged, and straight away they knew they were coming with a message. So messengers or runners were given protection, food, and safe passage through the land. And they were making arrangements with the next group to say, the bungye nuts are going to be ready at a certain time. Give it another month or so forth. Always before. That way, give them time to get organized and to make that long trek down. Because it wasn't just the men, it was the women and the children. They all come down for the bungye season. And what they do in this area here? Highly organized. There were certain trees in certain areas which were allocated to different clan groups. And no one else touched those. And they knew exactly where their trees were and where they could harvest and where they could camp. And so highly organized structure. It wasn't just to get the nuts. What were the people here going to get out of it? They'd bring down things for trade. Now you imagine going further out west, where we have Gidgee, Mulga, Black Wattle, hardwood, makes good boomerangs, good spears. And so they were brought into trade. Red ochre was used for ceremony, for initiation, for death, all sorts of things for ceremony. The red ochre ground up and rubbed on the body. We weren't the only ones to use that. You go to Egypt. If anyone's been to the Museum of Antiquities in Cairo, I've been there about 5 times. And red ochre, the pharaohs had red ochre rubbed all over before they were bandaged up in the linen. And so it's interesting to see. And so they brought that down to trade, coolamans, the wooden bowls or pitcher of water, many names for them. And that was the trading thing. And the next thing, what they do to settle disputes, marriage arrangements, because we had no inbreeding in this country. Our culture was so organized, you could do a PhD on our marriage arrangements quite easily, still today. Very in-depth, but works. And then for settling disputes, interesting, I have a degree in conflict resolution mediation with the Attorney General's Department. We did that long before Europeans arrived. Conflict resolution and mediation. It was a little bit harsher. For instance, if there was a problem, when the clan groups would come in, they'd have a place all cleared, no stones, no rocks, all nice and smooth. Then the one clan group had the problem with the other clan group, their family would sit up that end, the women and the children, everybody witnessed, and the elders, the same down the other end. Then the elders on both sides would talk about the problem loudly so everybody could hear. And then the warriors come out to do battle with each other to settle their dispute. They could club them, they could spear them in the leg, right, very rarely happened, but they could. But they could not put anyone to death because that would continue on the problem. And so what would happen? The elders would talk about what the problem was. And who was the mainstay to keep our women, men going? The women. And what did the women do? They yelled out loudly and challenged the other clan group and tell the women, your men are weak. They're not good warriors. And of course, what did we do? We didn't have clothes. You could see everything. The first thing they do to make the manhood go down, look at their penises. You know, we say voodoo, eh? Look at their penises. Small, how can they do any good for you? And everybody's getting all worked up. You know, you can imagine. So now the elders make a sign, the two lots of warriors would come out and do battle in the middle and everybody witnessing. Now, when it started to get out of hand, because the women are screaming out and yelling and getting the men all riled up, as they still do, you know. Anyway, and so when it was getting out of hand and the elders agreed it's gone far enough, we settled that dispute, they'd make signs to each lot of elders and then the elders would talk to their women and say it's finished. And those women then knew their role was running out on the battlefield and putting their arms around their husband's neck and calming them down and taking them back to sit down. It's done, it's done. Sit down, we're finished. The men are all still worked up and they don't really want to go, but the women get them back, you know, and sit them down. And then the elders are talking about it. Then everybody goes away to their little areas where their campsite is around the area. And then that night, that very night, they'd come together for a big festival, a big corroboree. There'd be food, campfires going, dancing and everything. The whole thing is done. It's not mentioned. So conflict resolution and mediation. Because if a whole clan group is still fighting, it disintegrates. Our elders knew that we had to calm everything down to get it working again. And if we could do that today, we wouldn't have all the wars we have because our culture did that. So to me, that is really, really a good, powerful point for our cultural structure of survival in that area.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe and check out our YouTube channel, Indigenous Health Med Talk. This podcast is a General Practice Training Queensland initiative, supported by Australian General Practice Training and the Australian Government.